Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Dan and Benny in the Ring. I'm Dan Sebastiano, joined, as always, by the BS Express himself, Benny Scala. Benny, how you doing today?
Not too bad, my friend.
Yeah, you know, every week, you're always giving me an update. How's the dating life treating you this week, Benny?
Well, I'm going to throw this one back at you, Dan, for once. Oh? Because, you know, I tried something different. This time I took her to the zoo, right? So okay. What would you think if an elephant threw peanuts back at her? What would you...
Well, my elephants are my wife's favorite exhibit at the zoo, so I can't answer that question without getting in too much trouble.
They never forget, though, right?
Absolutely. Oh, that's too funny. Well, you know, we have an interesting story to tell today. Joining us tonight's William Harding is a fan. One can only dream of having their own story, and our guest tonight is here to tell us one of the best fan stories in the history of wrestling's territory days. William Harding, thank you for joining us tonight. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very, very well, thank you. How are you guys doing this evening?
Fantastic.
Fantastic. Benny, you are, as a writer, you're always out there looking for a good story. So obviously you get the first question tonight. You have William Harding. He's here to tell us again a great story. So go for it, Benny.
I tell you what, this is to me one of the most fascinating stories. And this is going to be a different podcast than anything else we've done, because typically when we interview somebody, we're interviewing like a 30-year span of work, you know, in Dominic DiNucci's case, maybe a 50-year span. And in this case, we're actually, you know, we're going to talk about something that in actuality happened over a span of maybe 2 minutes, although it had, you know, far reaching implications, way beyond that. But it's just such a great story. And before we get to the main event, I've got to do a couple of preliminaries here. So this is going to be, you know, the curtain jerker. So Mr. Harding, you grew up in Frankfort, Kentucky, and, you had, I guess, very fortunate. You had a dad that was a police officer, and he worked events locally that at the time were run by the Memphis Territory. So you actually got to be backstage and meet some of the wrestlers. Was that how you became a fan, or were you a fan before that?
I was a fan before that. I used to get up on the weekends to watch that little spinning wrestling statuette come on to see Jarrett and Tojo and Bill Dundee and all those guys. And it was pretty fortunate that my dad worked down there. So when I got to go there, I was in the arena a couple hours before even the crowds got in there. So they turned me into the official door opener for all these guys, because they wanted to keep me sitting in one place for all the time. But I got to watch them set up the ring. I got to meet everybody. Really good group of people. I like them a lot.
How often did they visit your town? Was it weekly or monthly?
It was monthly, I believe.
Okay.
That was actually my first fan experience too, was I think the very first night. Jerry Jarrett and Tojo were doing a tag team event. And after it was all over, my dad took me back to the locker room, and I got to be back there with them for a little while, get to talk to them. Got my first autographed photo from both of them. And I just can't get, it's something I don't forget, because they were very respectful. They were great people. All the people in that locker room were great. It was just a legendary group of guys.
Growing up in New York, I had no access to Memphis wrestling, but now, like, I will find myself probably once a week, I'll go on YouTube and I'll watch an episode. It's so great. I mean, they had so many good characters on it. Lance Russell and Dave Brown were such a, in my opinion, probably one of the best announcing teams of all time, but their storylines and, yeah, and their feuds and everything, it was so real.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and the best part about it is, I'm sorry. The best part.
Oh no, I just wanted to interject real quick.
You can see it on TV, and I.
You were telling the you were telling the story. I just wanted to interject real quick. We've mentioned the Jerry Jarrett, and we've talked about Memphis and the Tennessee territories on the show before. However, for those that may not have caught what you were speaking of, you were talking about Tojo Yamamoto. He was a former Marine promoter and wrestler in the area. To give an idea of his success, just real quick side note, he, during his career, held the assorted tag team championships more than 50 times across the territories. He was one of the most proficient and prolific wrestlers of his day. So when you hear people talk about, in your story, you said, you know, Jerry and Tojo, that's who you're talking about. You're mentioning Jerry Jarrett, obviously, and Tojo Yamamoto. I didn't mean to cut you off. It's just, that's one of the names that tends to fall through the cracks sometimes in the territory stories. For the sake of the audience, I just wanted to make sure everybody knew who we were talking about. But please continue. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, Tojo Yamamoto is a name that people shouldn't forget because, I mean, when you got in the ring with that guy, you could tell that you better know what you're doing because even meeting him, you could just see the level of professionalism that both he and Jerry had at that time. But this was also the time where nobody had any kind of, alter identities. These guys, no music, no fancy lights, nothing. They, you know, they did the stories, they came out and they wrestled, and they wrestled hard. No theatrics, no gymnastics. Just straight up good professional wrestling, which is the same kind of wrestling I'd like to see today, which we don't see enough of, but only in the indies. And I encourage people to go out and watch some of these indie events because you're going to see a lot of good people out there wrestling like the old days, and like in Appalachian Mountain Wrestling. That's why I teamed up with them that we'll talk about later. But it was something great to go see. And I really enjoyed not only getting to see the matches, but getting to meet and know some of these guys. And it's just a huge thing when you're, I think I was 12 years old or 13 years old the first time I went, and these people are giants. You know, you meet them now and it's not quite the same, but they're just giant. When you're a kid, don't forget that.
Right. Absolutely. Let me ask you something to put a little more, I don't want to say context, but you were talking about seeing these monthly shows to kind of paint an image of how popular this stuff, wrestling was in the territory at the time. What kind of crowds were you seeing in these events every month when you would go to these shows?
Well, the ones in Frankfurt were held at the Frankfurt Civic Center. And the Civic Center would see, I think it was 6,600 people. And it was an event for them to come to town. So 1,000, 2,000 people easily. Mm-hmm. Frankfurt has always been a big town as far as pro wrestling goes, because you can really fill that place. And I think ICW was doing an average of about 1,000 people when they came. It was a very important town for them. But back in those days, it just seems like there were some nights where they almost filled that place because you couldn't watch it. I mean, you couldn't record it. So if you wanted to see the matches, you had to go. You know, we didn't have VCRs and stuff like that. You could only watch it on that one day. But if you wanted to see the live match, you had to go see what was going on. And it was just an event to go down there and watch everything. And I loved going. It was fun. You know, I was already in martial arts, and I was not only looking for a great event, but to try to pick up little things too I could use. So, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Benny?
So you just mentioned martial arts. And so I guess at the time of the challenge, you had already been into karate for 8 years and judo for 4 years. What got you involved? I know I think I heard you say it on a different interview, but what actually got you inspired to be, you know, begin martial arts training?
It was the actually. I was sitting in my room. We lived in a little apartment in Terrelinde in Frankfurt, and it was late at night. I was building a model rocket of all things, and
wait, was it an Estes model rocket?
Did, like this 5 minute. Yeah.
I was hooked on those things. When you said a model rocket, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but when you said a model rocket, that just brought back a whole flood of memories.
Oh yeah, going to Thornberry's and just going down that whole rack of stuff and just buying everything I wanted, except for the Saturn V, which my parents wouldn't let me have.
Ever did the Saturn V?
But yeah, that was the big one. But I was building the model rocket, and I'm watching TV, and this news report comes on about the death of Bruce Lee. And they were showing clips of his different films. And I remember seeing the clip where he's using the nunchucks in Enter the Dragon. And that got my attention. And I said, I want to do that. So next day, I go in there. I cut my mother's broom up, made a pair of nunchucks out of them.
Oh, no.
And told her later that I wanted to start saying, yeah. She didn't find that out for a couple of days. It was just that disappeared. But I told her I wanted to take martial arts. So she took me down to the YMCA, and I met a very nice man by the name of George Van Horn, who was the instructor, and started taking martial arts there. And it was a style called Chitokai Karate, which I think still has its home office in Covington, Kentucky. Yeah, very nice man. He's gone now. And then I went to his dojo that he had in Frankfurt, and that was a different experience totally, because I was 11 years old when I started. So when I finally went to the dojo, everybody in there was older than me. They were 14, 16 on up. So here I'm, this 11-year-old kid, little kid, against all these much bigger guys, which served me well later because I got used to dealing with bigger people, so it didn't bother me as much anymore. But it was also a time when, if you go to a martial arts school now, you'll see people that it's all about sportsmanship, it's all about respect, it's all about good nature and building your body and going to tournaments. We didn't have any of that. Respect, yes. That wasn't demanded. You earned it. But we didn't have the safety gear. As a matter of fact, one of the instructors, Mr. Van Horn's instructor, was there at the dojo that when I went to it. And the first lesson he taught me was that if somebody throws a punch at you, break their arm. If somebody throws a kick at you, break their leg. You do what you have to do to get the fight over with and get out of there. That isn't taught today.
Right.
And yeah, it's kind of shocking when you're that young to learn that.
Now, the idea of martial arts being entirely for self-defense and, you know, get out as safely and quickly as possible is a, I don't want to say a new concept, but I've heard stories, especially from some of the older practitioners I've worked with through the years. Martial arts classes in the 70s were a lot, like you said, they were a lot more brutal. That's a great
Cobra
word
for them. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Mercy is for the weak.
Right.
Sort of. Yeah. But ours was tempered with the fact that you respected people. You said sir to your elders. You gave people courtesy whenever you could. So there was that. But if it ever came to the point that you ever had to defend yourself, expect to get hit, expect to get hurt, but do what you have to do. And that martial arts was a weapon of last resort. So if somebody came up and wanted to fight you, if you could pick up a metal pipe or you could pick up a 2x4, you pick it up. you know, it, because if you had to go hand to hand, you expected to get hurt. And it's just something you had to deal with. So you get used to taking hits and you get used to taking punches and it gets you through it.
Interesting. You know, at the top of the show, I mentioned you have what is arguably the greatest story I've ever heard from a fan perspective of the territory days. And that's Benny, if we can kind of transition into the heart of that, because I think your martial arts background plays exactly into what we were talking about in the beginning. And that's your involvement in a wrestling segment from the day called the Sugar Hole Challenge. For those unaware, I'll tell you what, Benny, you're the author. Why don't you tell everybody what was the Sugar Hole Challenge?
So, and Mr. Hardy, correct me if I'm wrong. The wrestler's name was Bob Roop, who most people know from championship wrestling from Florida. He was in Kevin Sullivan's, I call it the Army of Darkness, as Meha Singh. But he was really Bob Roop, who's a phenomenal, I believe he's an Olympic medalist wrestler. And he had what's called a Sugar Hole Challenge. And I want to backtrack, and, you know, whoever listens to this, you know, it might be a bunch of people our age, or, you know, but I think this story is really applicable just for somebody younger, because this is something that you will never see in your lifetime ever again, I believe. I don't think anything, unfortunately, something like this will never happen. So, but back in the day, this was something that, you know, you could actually challenge a wrestler. And in Bob Roop's case, he had what's called a sugar hold. And Mr. Harding, you explained it. I think it was almost like a hip toss, but it was inverted on the ground. I think you said that in an interview. I'm not sure if I got that quite right. But so Mr. Roop, when he was part of Angelo Poffo's promotion, was ICW, International Championship Wrestling. And Angelo Poffo, you know, Macho Man's dad, Lanny's dad, also known as the Miser, they were putting up $1,000, and I believe it was $1,000 and 1,000 silver dollars if anybody could break Bob Roop's sugar hold. And so before I get too much into it, I wanted to ask Mr. Harding, so the day of, I guess, when did you find out about it? Obviously, back in the day, you know, it would be maybe advertised on their TV show. It would be in the paper, you know, the newspaper, something like that. How far in advance did you know about it? And then, like, did you make up your mind right away that you were going to try it?
It was about 3 or 4 weeks before the actual event. ICU was aired on WTVQ in Lexington. I was still in Frankfort at the time. And just one day, Bob Roop comes out with this bag of 1,000 silver dollars. And he starts spreading them across the table. And he starts talking about the Sugar Hole Challenge and how it was going to be open to professionals, amateurs, anybody. Come test yourself. And they were going to do it at a couple of different venues. And I was watching, I thought, well, that's an interesting test. Because going back to martial arts, there wasn't a lot of tournaments going on at the time. So in order to test yourself, you had to find different ways to do it. And there just really wasn't anything out there. So, okay, here comes an Olympian. Okay, you want to get in the ring with me? Come get in the ring with me. Try it out. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't know anything about the nefarious history of the sugar hole, which I have now learned more in the last 4 months than I've ever known in my life. But, you know, I didn't know about the snake where he's stretching people for, I think it was Eddie Graham. I didn't know about the background. I didn't know they used it as a tool to torture people. I just knew that here's an Olympian saying, get in the ring and, you know, try to do something that is impossible. You're not going to do it. Okay, I'll go do that. And so it was about 4 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks before the challenge. And while I'm watching the show, I'm trying to think about doing it. And there was something that came to me about a year ago that just reminded me of what happened was, I was watching watching the show, and like I said, this was the days before, I think VCRs were just coming in. And I'd seen Bob do the sugar hold on the show and, you know, submit people on the show with it. But I had to sit there. I went to my room and I got a sketch pad out and I came back and I started sketching out what it looked like on the ground so that I could just kind of try to analyze it and see what the best way was to deal with it. But I sat there for 30, after I sketched this whole thing out, I'm sitting there staring at it for like 30 minutes. And the show had already gone off at that point, and I can't figure this thing out. It's a really, really good hold. So I threw the sketch on the ottoman, and I got up to went to get something to eat. When I came back in the living room, I'm walking back to the chair, and the sketch pad's laying on the ottoman, except now I'm looking at it from a different angle. And if you take the sugar hold and you stand it up, it's a hip toss. It's just a regular, straightforward judo hip toss. If you put the guy who's putting the hold on you in the same position, you've got the advantage because your arm, you know, his arm's around the back of your neck, but your arm's around his back. And if he's reaching down to your leg, then he's leaning over, and all you got to do is twist, and you can take him down to the ground. And honestly, I think that's where it came from. I think that's where it originated from, as sort of a counter to a hip toss. So I thought, okay, if I get in the ring and do this, why can't I, in the starting position, just take him over face first into the mat? So I tried it out. I went down to the YMCA. I got some of my friends to go down there with me, and I tried it out with them, and it worked. And the plan was to do that, bring the behind him, and I could lock his arm up, and then the challenge would be over. Well, the problem with Bob Roop is he's like 800 pounds more than I am. So when we start talking about this, it didn't quite work the same. So I had to adjust for that. But that's what I worked on for 3 or 4 weeks before I went down there. So I knew what I was going to do when I got there. And the karate didn't really play a part physically, but it helped me mentally because, like I said before, I was used to dealing with bigger people, so that didn't bother me. The only thing that I got a little unnerved about was that this guy was an Olympian, and to get to that level, you're really, really good. But I didn't know about his background. I didn't know about him being in the Army or anything else like that, or the NCAA championships or anything. So I just knew he was an Olympian, and I knew it was going to be difficult to deal with. But the one thing I told myself was no matter what happened, I wasn't going to give up. I was going to earn his respect. At least that's what I thought was going to happen. And it turned out a little different. But that's what it was for me leading up to it, was that I just planned for it right down to the clothes I was wearing that night, and went down there that night to see what I could do.
Just curious, did anybody try to talk you out of it?
Yep. I told my friends about it. They told me I was crazy. I told my grandmother about it, and she begged me not to do it. I told my grandfather about it, and he said, no, you're not going to do it. And I told my dad about it, and he absolutely forbade me from even going down there. And
was there anybody who said you had a challenge?
No.
No, they are everybody no. Unanimous against it.
I mean, I'm 150 pounds and 5'7" tall. Little of nothing. But I was strong because apart from martial arts, I was into roller skating, skateboarding. I was going to the fitness center all the time. Even at my size, I was doing this, these vertical calf raises. I don't know if you're familiar with that. You're basically standing up on a platform and you put these bars across your shoulders.
Yeah. Yes.
And you basically lift up with your toes off your heels and just do standing calf raises. And I'm 150 pounds, I'm 5'7", and I'm doing a set of 20 of those at 900 pounds. Wow. Which is the max the machine
That's
had.
Impressive.
I had good abdominal strength. I had good leg strength. And I felt like I knew what I was doing. But I had a lot of people that said, I wouldn't do that. Or if it was me, I wouldn't do that. And to me, that just spurs me on. Because, yeah, I know you won't do it, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, at 19, you're bulletproof. You know, 39, maybe a different story. When you're 19, you can do anything.
Mm. Yeah. You think you know the world. And then you turn 20.
Exactly. It's the key word, thanks.
So we've set the stage. Yeah. So here you are. You're limber. You studied judo, martial arts. You're deceptively strong. Roop calls you into the ring, and he's going to lock on the sugar hold, and $1,000 in silver coins on the line. Lay out the story. Tell us how this goes.
Well, when I went there, there was about three or four matches before they even got to it. They did this right before intermission, so I didn't watch the other matches. I just kept my head down and kept focused on my mind what I was going to do. And then they finally called us down there, and there was four of us total. We all had to sign waivers. And the first guys got in there. And I remember, and I told Bob Roop this, and he thought it was hilarious, but the first guy that got in there, he was probably about Roop's height. Kind of skinny, but he was wearing like black jeans, this silky black shirt, and he had this Lyle Lovett looking. And he was being kind of a smart aleck. So when they laid down there and Bob put the sugar hold on him and the referee said go, this guy was done in 3 seconds. He screamed. And he was waving his hands, and Bob let him go, and he got up, and he was just so disgusted.
Bob Roop made him humble.
And
Iron
I was talking
Sheik
to
style.
The other guys. Yeah, yeah. But that's the one thing I learned is that, you know, and it's another one of those things I just want to kind of emphasize about those days, because there's a lot of revisionist history about what went on. You don't disrespect these guys, because they'll make you pay for it.
Right.
Big time. But the guy in front of me that was going third was, I think he was in the Army, and he was talking about what he was going to try to do. And he was a little nervous after he saw that first guy. But I was kind of worried about him because he said he was in the Army. And I thought, okay, well, this guy's got combat training, so he might know what to do. He actually lasted about 15 seconds, I think, before he submitted. And I went up there, and I got in the ring. And I walked over there to him. I didn't even look Bob in the face because all I saw was he was wearing that. And I'm sure you've seen it, that uniform of his with the Olympic rings on it and the USA and the USA boots. Yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, Jesus, this is really happening. So I just laid down on the mat. And I remember hearing the referee and him giggling. And Bob said, well, okay, then. And he got down on the mat and he put me in the sugar hold. And it's one of those instances right there where time kind of stands still and you see the dust floating in slow motion in front of you and all that. And I'm just watching the referee, because when the referee says go, I'm going between the G and the O, because I had to get that first move off before he could do anything.
Before he locked it up.
I just didn't want to give him the chance. Yeah. Well, he already had it locked. I mean, it was already locked in there. So you're starting from the sugar hold. It's not a shoot or anything. You're starting from the sugar hold. You're in the submission hold, and the referee says go, and I just go as hard as I can, and I twisted my body and brought him over face first into the mat. And like I said before, he didn't go all the way over, but he went over far enough where I could go spread eagle on the mat with my legs, and I got my right arm down enough where I could lean into it. So I actually had him in an exaggerated arm bar, and the crowd just changed immediately because everybody was kind of laughing at me when I got in the ring. They thought it was hilarious. Oh, here's this puny guy getting in the ring after they've seen these other guys. And then all of a sudden shock. You know, here's an MMA crowd now. On their feet, jumping around. I'm looking up, seeing what's going on. I've still got him in the arm bar. Referee keeps asking me if I want to give up. I held him there like that. Now I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do because he's still on top of me. And I put my right arm down and I start pressing up like a push-up. And I got all the way up with him on my back. And the idea was I was going to try to get my legs out from underneath of him and switch it to a full arm bar and just lock the arm up like I had planned to do in the first place. And as soon as I got to the top of the push-up, the one-arm push-up, I could hear him say to the referee, "Damn, this boy's strong." And just a microsecond before I'm going to try to get my legs out, he grabs my left leg and flings me back around, trying to get me back to the starting position, except I went too far. And what happened was I landed on my back, and as soon as I landed on my back, I kicked my legs up, and I scissor lock his head. So now neither one of us are in a real comfortable position right now because my nose is like literally 8 inches from the side of my right knee. That's how I've been up. My head is locked up in his arm. I've got him in a scissor lock, and all I can do is push back against his arm and try to slip my head out while I'm crushing his head. This goes on, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds. I hear him say to the referee, "Get this boy off me. He's killing me."
Wow.
So I finally get my head to slip out of his arm. I roll him over to the side and I kick away from him. I actually think I kicked him right in the chest to try to get away from him. And I jumped up and then I realized what happened and I threw my arms up. Everybody in the place is screaming. You know, they're jumping up and down. Bob's still on the mat. The referee's still on the mat. I turn around, look at the audience behind me. They're all jumping up and down. And I turn back around. The referee's on his feet. And this is where it all goes haywire. He's going, "No, no, no. You didn't beat the time limit. You didn't win. Oh, it's on." I got so angry. And I said, "Bullshit. I just didn't know what to say to him." And I start pointing my finger at him and I'm like, you know, "I won." And Roop had gotten up at that point. And I looked at Roop and I said, "This is bullshit." And he said, "You know, you didn't beat the time limit, blah, blah, blah." And I said, "If you don't think I beat the time limit, get your ass back down there and we'll do it again." Well, I don't know what he was thinking at this point, because I'm pretty sure that nobody ever asked to get put in a sugar hole twice. But this is where it all gets kind of strange, too. And I talked about this once before, but during the course of this argument that was going on, Bob says, "Stand still for a second." Puts his hands on the side of my head. And I'm like, "Oh, God, what's happening now?" And he said, "Hold still." And he's looking at me. And he said, "You've ruptured a bunch of blood vessels in your eye. So he's not going to do it again because in all honesty, he's not going to let me get injured anymore."
Mm-hmm.
That's what I can tell. At the time, I didn't realize this. I was just angry. I wanted to do it again. I wanted to prove it wasn't a fluke. And he's saying no. And I realized later on, much later on, that he was trying to keep me from injuring myself anymore. And it's true. My eye was just blood red. It's a brutal, brutal hold. So I asked them about the time limit. And I said, "You're not wearing a watch. He's not wearing a watch. Who's keeping time?" And he said, "The timekeepers down at the table are keeping the time." So we argue some more and they leave the ring. So I'm standing there and I look over at these two basically kids. They're teenagers sitting over at the table. And I walk over there and I say, "All right, what's this thing about the time limit?" And they said, "Well, there was a 1 minute time limit." I said, "All right. Who's keeping time? Because Neither one of you have a watch on. There ain't no stopwatch here, and there ain't no clock you can see. They don't say a word. They just kind of look at each other, and they get up, and they walk away. They walk to the back of the arena and go out the door toward the locker room. And now I'm left in the ring, you know, not knowing what to do. And there's a friend of mine from high school. His name is Steve Ott, and he was sitting in the front row. And he just yelled at me. He said, he got my attention. And I said, Steve, I don't think they're going to pay me. And he said, grab the mic. That's a great idea.
Cut a promo.
I walk over to I go to the timekeeper's table and I grab the mic. And the first thing I says, I want my money. And I keep saying that. And I tell the people in the audience, I said, I came out here for a challenge. They say I didn't beat a time limit. I beat the time. You know, there wasn't a time limit because nobody was keeping time. I want my money. Well, nothing happens for about 5 minutes. And then I see this figure come out from the ring. And then I recognize about halfway there, Bob Ojeding. And he says, hey, boy, put the mic down and come over here. So I set the mic down and I walked over there. And he said, look, he said, Bob Roop's a good guy. And he said, it would be in your best interest to just get out of the ring and forget about all this. Otherwise, I'm going to get in the ring and put you in a hole to make you tongue suck your dick. Okay.
All righty.
I don't think I said anything to him, but I was standing there with my hands on the second rope and my head really close to the first rope. And he was within reaching distance, and I kept thinking in my head, just slap the crap out of him. But that's where the karate training took over. And I thought, that's a really, really bad idea, because one, it gives them an out legally, and secondly, he would kill me. He would get in the ring and literally kill me, and I'd give him an excuse to do it. So I didn't do that, and I just kind of stayed in the ring, and I stood there in the center of the ring. And he walked away, and he stood back there at the doorway kind of taunting me. And I said, hell with this. And I went back over and grabbed the mic. I want my money now. Well, here's where it gets weird. Because a couple minutes later, I guess they're just done with the intermission. They want to get on with everything else. And then here comes somebody else. And it's I can't remember who came out first, but I think it was Pez Watley. Pez Watley comes walking out of the ring, walking out to the ring with her boxing gloves. And then just about a minute later, here comes Rip Rogers to the ring with a pair of boxing gloves. They're going to have a boxing match, a 10-round boxing match. And I'm still in the ring. I'm refusing to leave. And here comes the arena manager, Roy Thurman, with two police officers. And they told me to come over and talk to them. And they told me, you need to get out of the ring now. And I said, no. So the police officers step up and they say, get out of the ring now or we're going to arrest you. Okay, fine. So I step out of the ring. So instead of going back to my seat, which probably would have ended all this, they take me to the back and lock me up in a storeroom. And I don't know what to do now. So I'm in this room and there's a telephone there, and I called my stepmother and I told her to get me a lawyer down there because, you know, I'm fed up with these guys and I need to do something. And I told her what happened. And I guess one of the police officers outside heard what was going on, and he rushed into the room and told me to get off the phone. And I told him I was calling a lawyer and he didn't care. He just said, get off the phone. So I put the phone down. And then the arena manager came in later and he said, they're not going to pay you. They said, you didn't beat the time limit and they're just not going to pay you. So I told him, I said, well, you better go talk to him again because I'm getting paid. Because if you're going to take away the accomplishment, you're going to pay me. So he goes back there and he comes back about 5-10 minutes later and he said, I talked to him again. And they're just not going to pay you. But they said, if you want to stay and watch the rest of the event, you're more than welcome to stay. And I said, well, yeah, I did pay for a ticket.
How generous of them, right?
How, yeah, that's what I was going to say. How generous of them. So there was the stack of posters laying next to me and a pencil. And I said, do you mind if I take one of these? And he just kind of looked at me quizzically. And he said, no, go ahead. So I go up there and I try to find the first three guys, because I decided at this point, okay, I'm going to sue these guys. I'm going to bring them into court and I'm going to deal with it there. And I found the first guy that I told you about, and I asked him if he wanted to help me out and be a witness, and he didn't want nothing to do with it. He was already embarrassed enough about that whole thing in the thing. But the second and third guy signed it, and then a couple of other people asked me what was going on, and they started signing it. And the next thing I know, I'm just surrounded by people. They're all signing this thing. And while this is going on, I could hear somebody saying, Bill, you know, my nickname. And I turn around and I know who this guy is. His name is Sam Harrod. He's the sheriff in Frankfort. And he asked me to come over there for a second. And he said, aren't you Billy Harding's boy? Because Sam worked with my dad while he was on the police force. Sam has been sheriff of Frankfort for a long time. And he had worked with my father while my dad was still serving on the Frankfort police force. And so he knew the family. And he said, tell me what's going on. So I start telling, and I look around, and here come those two police officers that had dragged me out of the ring before. And they said, all right, you're coming with us. We're going to arrest you for causing a disturbance. And I'm like, you're kidding. And they said, no. And they take me back, put me back in that same storage room again. And I'm like, when will this ever end? Now I'm angry. Before I did all this, I was a really shy kid, but this thing just flipped like a switch, and just that night just changed me so much. I'm sitting by this room again. I am furious at these guys, and I'm telling the police officers, why are you harassing me? Why aren't you out there? I'm the one that got ripped off. Why aren't you talking to them? But they're not having. And I come to find out later that, you know, whoever's renting the arena, they're the ones that have to pay the police officers. So technically, they were working for ICW. And so I'm sitting in this room again. They're outside. They won't let me leave the room. And a few minutes later, Sheriff Sam Harrod comes walking in. And he asked me to tell him the full story of what was going on. And I did. And he said, you sit right here. I'll be right back. About 10 minutes later, Sam comes walking in. Here's Angelo Poffo walking in with him. And he's like, okay, how are we going to settle this thing? At first he says, will you take $250? And I just kind of shake my head no, because, you know, I was just frustrated with the whole thing at that point. He said, how about 500? 500's a good deal. And I said, look, after what you all put me through tonight, I'm not leaving here with less than $1,000. And he just looks over at Sam and he shakes his head and he just walks out of the room. And Sam said, you wait here. I'll be right back. And I can't remember how long I was, probably about another 15, 20 minutes. And they came back and Sam came in and he said, come with me. So when I go out of the room, I could hear all this booing going on out in the auditorium. And I walk out I got two police officers escorting me. I got Sam, I'm walking with Sam, two police officers behind me. And I thought, what's going on now? And as soon as I walk out, cheering starts, all this cheering starts. And they said, come on up in the ring. So I get up in the ring and Angelo Poffo is there. Bob Roop's there. The referee's there. And, Angelo takes the mic and he starts explaining to the audience that about what was going on, and that he felt like there was a miscommunication about the time limit. And he said, because of that, we feel like we're going to go ahead and pay the young man, you know, for what he did. And then he gave me a check for $1,000. Now, for a brief second there, bag of silver dollars. That's what I really wanted. And I think I'd be better off just taking the chance. I shook his hand. I shook Bob's hand. I shook the referee's hand. Shook Sam's hand, and I waved to everybody in the audience, and I got out of the ring and I made my way to the exit. I wasn't going to stay for anything else. I got outside, and they have these big concrete square planters out in front of the center. And I got, and there's all these people standing out front too. And I got up on one of those things and I jumped up and I started screaming, and everybody thought I was just insane. And then I stopped and looked around at everybody, and then I ran to my car. Because the thought jumped into my mind, okay, what if these guys are coming after me now to get that check back? And I got to my car, and I couldn't get the keys into it fast enough. But got in there. And then now, here's where it really got to me, because my dad forbid me from going down there. Now, he knew I was going to go down there that night. Because I said, I'm going to go down there and watch the event. And he said, that's fine, but don't you get in that ring. Fine, sure. Fingers crossed, you know. And I get home. I put the keys in the door, and I walk in expecting the nuclear explosion to happen as soon as I go in. And I go in the kitchen, and my stepmom's in there, and I said, where's Dad? She said, he went down to the arena to get you. Oh. So I have to sit there like 30 minutes or so waiting for him to come home, because I know he's just going to lay into me when he gets there. And I could hear those keys in the door, and I'm thinking, oh man, I am so done. And he comes in and he starts screaming at me. I told you not to go down there. I told you to stay out of that ring. I told you not to get in the ring with that man. On and on and on. And then he just stops. He stares at me for a few seconds and he says, let me see the check. So I showed it to him, and I could tell he was mad, but he also was kind of proud. And it turned into one of those stories that he used to tell his friends. You know, he tended bar for a long time, and he would tell his friends about it. And actually, some of the friends would come by the house to come look at me and say, that's him. And, it's turned into one of those fun little stories that he could tell his friends after that. And that's pretty much the story of what happened that night. And it was just insane. The whole episode was insane.
That's absolutely incredible.
Is it true, though, that Angelo Poffo was threatened with arrest if he didn't pay you?
Yeah. I went and bought the State Journal contacted me the next morning and asked me about it. It was in the local newspaper.
Who contacted you the next morning?
And asked me to come down. The Frankfort State Journal.
Okay.
That was the local newspaper. They wanted me to come down and talk about it because somebody had contacted them about it. So I went down there and told them the story, and they wrote it up. And I told them I was going to get a thank you card for Sam. And after I left there, I went to Lexington to cash the check. And that's kind of a funny story in itself, because I drove to Lexington. I think it was drawn on the Bank of Lexington. And I took it up there, and I took the check to the cashier. And they said, what do you want to do with this? And I said, I just want to cash it, take it back to Frankfort, put it in my bank account. And they said, okay. And they said, hold on a second. And I see the teller go over to the bank manager, and the bank manager looked at the check, and he went over and got on the phone. And I knew who he was calling. He was calling Angelo Poffo. And I could hear him on the phone. And I heard him say, well, he's here now. What do you want me to do with it? And I thought, if he stops this check, I'm going to go to his house. And they went ahead and cashed it. And I had stopped at Kinko's before there, or some other copy place, and made a copy of it before I left, before I went to the bank. But they cashed it, and I took it back to Frankfort. And I went and bought a thank you card for Sam. And I took it over to the sheriff's office. and I gave him the thank you card, and he told me the story about what he had mentioned to Angelo, and a quote from Sam himself. He said, "I went back there and told that man that if he didn't pay you, that he's going to spend a night in my hotel." So he was going to put him in jail. And the other deputy, he had another deputy was standing there. And I've heard that a lot from about that time. The other deputy looked at me and he said, "This is him." Because I was little. But yeah, but Sam Harrod was one of those good old boy sheriffs that he was your best friend. But if there was somebody causing trouble, he would let you know who the law is. He was around, he was probably in his late 50s, early 60s, wore a cowboy hat. He was like a regular Andy Griffith around there. He would lay down the law when the law needed to be laid down. So I really like Sam. I miss him. He was a really, really good guy. But he stood up for me that night. And he's a large reason why that whole event turned out in my favor.
Yeah. How's that old song go about fought the law and the law won?
I fought authority. Authority always wins.
Yeah.
That is absolutely incredible. I mean, you have, like I said at the top of the hour, and I've heard you tell the story before, and it only gets better hearing some of the details that weren't in the last time I heard you tell it. It's literally a kid. You were a kid, 19 years old. It's a kid to me, getting before these larger than life heroes, holding, not only beating them at their own game, but holding your own when push came to shove.
And it was a legit world class athlete. It wasn't even just, you know, an ordinary wrestler. You know, Roop was, he was a gold medal, not a gold medal. He was an Olympic medalist, though, right?
I think he placed seventh, but.
Oh, okay.
He lost to the gold medalist.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, and then a lot of other things, like I said, a lot of things that I learned about Hampshire Hall, things I've just learned in 4 years about the hold itself and Bob Roop. And I didn't know what a hornet's nest I was walking into when I went down there. I was just there to compete. That was my honest intention, just to go in there and test myself and see where I was professionally as far as my martial arts training was going. And it's one of those things that I still look back now and try to analyze to see what I could have done better, because there were elements of it that I could have changed, like at the end where I rolled him over and let him out of the scissor lock. I keep thinking, you know, as much as that referee asked me if I want to give up, I should have locked his arm up, kept the scissor lock on, then asked the referee if he wanted to give up, because I was pretty mad at that referee. But I don't know. It's just, and I've heard a lot of, and this is something I want to talk about for a second, if you don't mind. I've heard a lot of pro wrestlers talk about the sugar hole in the last couple of years. And in Bob's original interview that I think is on my channel, he was talking about how he couldn't get a good lock on the hole because I was small and skinny. And I basically squirted out of the hole. I fought my way out. Bob was the one that ended that hold. I ended the hold because I'm the one that ended it with the scissor lock on his head. I let him go. Anybody who thinks that, it just boggles my mind to think that skinny guys get out of the sugar hole because they're small. It's insane. Try it. I encourage people to try it, because here you've got a world-class athlete, a shooter, a guy who Brian Last said brutalized guys in the snake pit, that would come in there. And that video's out there on YouTube right now called Bob Roop Stretches a Wadami or something like that.
I've seen that.
I mean, that's mm-hmm. only a couple of years before I had to deal. That's only a couple of years before I had to deal with it. If you're saying that guy can't deal with a 150-pound kid you know, and that the sugar hole won't work on a 150-pound kid, try it. And the reason I got out of it was because I was trained. I mm-hmm. had a good instructor. I had good instructors. I had good people to work with. I sat there for 2 or 3 weeks trying to figure it out. And I ended that hold. You're not going to get out of that because you're skinny. It just isn't going to happen. Try it. And the thing you were talking about earlier about, you know, you're not going to see it anymore. The reason you're not going to see it anymore is because after that, they did it again. They never talked about it again. They, you know, they filmed it. They never showed it. I've tried to get that film for years. They never showed it. According to when I talked to Jim Cornette about it, he said it wasn't uncommon for them to take the tapes and just reuse them. That footage is probably lost forever. But if it's out there somewhere, show it. I encourage, I dare them to show it. You know, let everybody see it. Let everybody see what happened. And I want to see it. You know, I didn't have a good angle where I was. So
you were a little too busy to watch the festivities, huh?
Otherwise engaged.
Yeah, right. I was a little busy at the time. Yeah. Yeah.
So were you a local celebrity after that? Because you're in a newspaper, and, you know, back in the day, the newspaper was a big deal. Were you recognized on the street or, like, you know, when you're out and about in town that, hey, you're that guy?
Yeah, I think for about 3 or 4 months, yeah. There was a lot of people that were there. I knew a lot of people. They'd come over with my stepbrother. They'd come over to the house, and they would talk about it. Or I would just see people out, and they'd say, oh, you're that guy from the ICW thing. I'd say, yeah. And but it went on for, like, you know, it's not like today where it gets on social media and it just blasts out to the world. It was just like, it was a dark house show. But that's what was kind of weird about it when, and talking about it today, in that it was a dark. I didn't talk about it. They never mentioned it again. And Bob Roop left the territory and went to Louisiana not too long after that. And they never aired the footage, nothing. And yet Jim Cornette said he heard about it. When I was talking to him about it, he said he heard about it in the Tennessee Valley down Smoky Mountain. And this was kind of weird to me. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say that's actually part of the mythos of that story is – one of the reasons the territories worked so well is because everything was isolated. You wrestled in a territory, your shows were there, your secrets were there. You could go to another territory and be a completely new person. The fact that other territories started hearing the story of this kid that beat Roop in the ring shows just how big of a story that was.
Yeah, it was so bizarre because I've had, apart from wrestlers coming up and asking me how I did it, which in and of itself is kind of, I mean, it's the feeling like when you go to like a Comic-Con or something and you meet celebrities and they're basically like, okay, I want to sign my autograph for you. I'll say hi to you, but I want you to move on so I can get to the next person. Well, I've got people that I've watched on TV, like Jim Cornette or Al Snow, Bobby Blaze, you know, all these guys who actually want to hear the story and they want to talk to me about it. Bobby Blaze introduced me to Bobby Eaton and he wanted to know. He wanted me to show him how I did it. So I'm at Bobby Fulton's retirement show, but showing Bobby Eaton how I did this. And explaining it to him. And it's bizarre because I've watched all these people on television. It's like when I first did the interview on 605 about this back in 2017. And before they aired the interview, they did a promo for it on Jim Cornette's experience. And Brian starts explaining it. And Jim's talking about, oh, I know this story. This story is legendary in the Tennessee community and maybe in wrestling in general. And my mouth just hit the floor when I heard that. Jim Cornette knows his story. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about how famous it is within the wrestling community. And I'm like, I didn't know anything about the 605 or the crowd or Brian or anything else. And I started looking this up, and then I started getting nervous, which I'm glad I did the interview before I knew all that, because I didn't know how big that community was. And after the interview aired, I had a Twitter account that had 39 people on it. And in a day, one day, it went from 39 people to over 6,000. And then it got up to like 9,000 something. And at one point it was 100 people every 12 minutes.
Incredible.
Watching it. Jeez Louise. I've had people contact me from all over, they send me emails from all over the world asking about it and, you know, going to Franklin County and all this other stuff. And it's just, it's weird that the story's been floating out there. And not only that, I've had people not only tell me that they've heard the story, but where they were when they heard the story. I'm like, man, yeah.
That's
it's amazing. It's the wrestling community is an amazing thing.
Well, I've said before on the show, and I'll continue to believe it forever, wrestling fans are simultaneously the greatest and worst human beings in the history of mankind. And some of it is just creates such an atmosphere that you get nowhere else, not boxing, not UFC, not football, nowhere else. Wrestling fans are, like I said, great and awful at the same time, but it is such an atmosphere. And your story would not have worked anywhere besides a territory. The crowds wrestling has today wouldn't have reacted that way if they had pulled you into the ring. And I just think it's incredible. I said it at the top of the show, and I continue to believe it. Benny mentioned it. We talked about this a bit before we recorded. That's the greatest story I've ever heard from a fan perspective of a territory taping. I mean, yeah, people talk about the first time they saw Andre the Giant or the first time they had these moments. You literally conquered the mountain and held your own, and you have you are a part of wrestling history forever, and that's just absolutely incredible.
Well, that's what can I say? That's like some of the greatest compliments I've ever heard. I'll tell you another funny thing about it was that people that I'd known for years and people that I had told when I was going to go down there and do this, it was like a week after they went out with my skateboarding friends, and they were convinced that I was now working for ICW, that the whole thing was a work, and that Bob Roop and I had, and I had talked to Jeff Smith about it. You might remember him as Izzy Slapowitz.
Oh, yeah.
Angela was convinced that Roop and I had planned this thing out and that we were going to split the money. And Roop was wanting to leave the territory anyway. And this was sort of his way of getting back at him. But I can tell you from my position in all this, he wasn't giving nothing away. But I was out of wrestling for so long. I was really frustrated with that night for me. And it was something that I was talking to Jeff Smith about, was that good memories that I had with my dad going to the Memphis shows or the events. I got to say events because Bo James will kill me if I don't say that. Don't call them shows. Going to the Memphis events, that was a good time for me because I got to spend time with my father and everything. It was just a great thing. And when I started going to the other shows, I found to relive that experience with my father. And it didn't feel the same. And then after this event, happy that it had a good outcome, but I was really angry with the whole thing. And it put me off of it for a long time. And I didn't watch wrestling again for probably 15 years. And I started watching right around the time that Hollywood Hogan showed up in WCW. But 96. It was about 4 years ago when I did the interview with 605. And after I did that, I'd met up with Bo James, who runs Southern States Wrestling. Really good promotion down in Tennessee. And he was also wrestling with Appalachian Mountain Wrestling and doing some other indie groups like Thoroughbred Wrestling over in Moorhead, Kentucky. And I met up with him in Moorhead, and he invited me to come down to an AMW show in Combs, Kentucky. And Ronnie Garvin was going to be there, and Barb Batten was going to be there. And I went down there, and I saw the show, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought to myself, well, I've done a lot of photography, I've done a lot of video. I wouldn't mind doing video sites, put it on my Twitter page, since I've got all these followers. I started talking to Kyle Maggard, who runs AMW. And that turned into me working with them as the official cameraman to do their shows for the CBS affiliate in Hazard. And I got to meet a lot of great people through that. So here's what really got me about today's wrestling is that you see a lot of people who are very jaded about it. And I see them on Twitter and they talk about, you know, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. I don't really like this, but we were in McKee, Kentucky, really small town. I got a couple of relatives that live there and we were doing an AMW event there. And it was the first night that I had to be the announcer because our guy couldn't make it that night. So we get through the whole night. It's a great crowd for such a really, really small town. And the event's over, and I'm walking back from the ring. And there's this kid who's like maybe 9 years old. And he's signaling for me to come over to the barrier. And I said, what's up? And he said, I got to talk to you about something. So I go around to the side of the barrier where he is, and I sit down. And he goes to me and starts talking about every cheating aspect that just happened in this entire show. And he doesn't miss a beat. He's got it all down by memory of every little cheat that happened in that match, in every match that happened. So I'm jotting this all down for him because he wants me to turn it into the guys who run AMW so they can get it corrected and they get those matches corrected. I think this is great. I mean, this is me back in the 70s. And I think how great this is. And I'm like, okay, I'll go back there and I'll tell these guys, I'll tell them what happened. And I shake his hand. I say, you know, you stay a wrestling fan. And he goes out and I go back there. And I see Kyle and Bo standing there. And I'm like, okay, you guys, I got to turn you both in. And then that's when I realized, you know, it's the kids. It's the people that believe and they love it. And they're wearing the belts and they're wearing the shirts and they're just loving. And this is just little indie shows. And I see more joy out of these kids than I see in some of the WWE events.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. And that's what I love about it. And I hope we can get past this COVID thing soon and we can get all the indie shows started back up again because I know they miss it. And it just inspires me because that's me, you know, back in the 70s. And it's just great to see now.
Yeah, we have a couple of indie promotions are kind of friends of the show. The VCW here in Virginia, SW Fury in Texas, and Devotion Championship Wrestling out in Utah. And it's great to see. And Benny, I know will agree with me that not only is it a completely different fan experience, but the quality of in-ring competition is better. The wrestling is not, it's not the cookie cutter, same three matches over and over again you see on some of the main shows. And it's truly, I know it sounds corny, but the smaller territories used to be the main, like they were the past of wrestling. And I think the smaller promotions are going to be wrestling's future because they're going to survive in ways that the mainstream promotions can't. And that's just my opinion anyway.
And ironically, they're doing a lot of the things well, that they did when back I went in the day.
Go ahead.
When I went to, I went to the CWF Fan Fest in 2018, and I did a panel with Bob Roop for the people that were in attendance there, and we were talking about this. It was run by Jeff Bowdern and Barry Rose, who do Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdern and Barry. And Barry Rose asked me if I wanted to do a panel with Bob, and I said, sure. So we did one on June 2nd, one day before like the 38th anniversary of the Sugar Hole Challenge. What was great about that was that, you know, getting to see him, and he heard the story from my perspective of what happened after he left the ring for the first time. And we all thought it was funny. No, it's fun. But here's the thing. When I talked to him after the event was over, and we talked about different things, and I had mentioned to him about ICW, and for all the good and bad feelings that I had about them at that time, they had a great roster. There's a lot of stars in that promotion. You know, when I started going, I was dating a girl named Chris, and she said, I want you to meet somebody, and she took me to meet. He was there with Randy, and they're just standing out there next to the merchandise table. And this was before, you know, both of them kind of skyrocketed. Randy went to the stratosphere with his career. But at the time, you could just walk up there and meet them, and it was just me and Chris and Lane and Randy just standing there talking. And great guys. And now, you know, with all the stuff that's going on, it's just, it's different. You can't do that anymore. So that's why I encourage people to go out to these indie promotions, because I know guys right now, like I said before, or when we were talking before this, that, you know, they're out there. One of them just got signed with the NWA. One just got signed with Impact. You're meeting the future stars of this genre. There's one at every promotion that has the potential to be a superstar. So go meet them, cheer them on. And get to know them, because they're hardworking people. It takes a lot to do it. I know we all feel like we know how everything works, but I can tell you from what I've learned just with AMW and UCW here in Western Kentucky, there's a lot more. It's a lot more complicated than people think. And these people are very talented and they're great athletes. And, you know, just go out there and enjoy a promotion. Just go enjoy the show. Is what I'm saying. But when I was talking to Bob at CWF, and I told him, I said, look what a great roster you guys had. He didn't really say anything. We were having breakfast together the next morning before I left Florida. And I said, but you know, you had Randy, you had Lanny, you had Rip, you had all these guys, you had Ox Baker, all these great guys. And I said, you guys put together a great roster. And he said something to me that it stuck with me. And I didn't understand it for a year, but I just needed a place to land. And I thought, that really doesn't make any sense. But it was about a year later that that Plan B video thing came out. And that's when I understood what he was talking about, because I think he was at the Knoxville territory before that, and that Plan B thing went down, and him and Ronnie Garvin and Bob Orton and Malenko and all those guys had to leave there, and they went up the road to Lexington, and they ended up in Angelo's promotion. And I thought, wow, you know, didn't know that happened. And I don't know. It's just, it's strange how things work out. But it was like I said, it's the hornet nest I walked into. So I didn't know about any of that stuff. Not sure it would have changed my mind about going to try it, but it was crazy.
A- absolutely. And you know, it's funny to it's just funny to think about it that way. Benny, as we obviously wrap up here in part, do you have any closing thoughts for the night?
Well, again, just an incredible story, and I hope the younger people listen to this, because it's something like phenomenal from the past that you will never see again. And maybe, you know, Mr. Harding is partially responsible for why we won't see it again, but it was a game changer. But I did have, did anybody ever approach you about becoming a wrestler?
A couple of years before I did the challenge, I had gone to, there was this flea market in Georgetown. They had wrestling there at this little Morton building on Saturdays. And I was there with my friend Chip Grider. And I saw that. And after we'd gone to a couple events, I thought, well, I've got, you know, 6 years, 7 years martial arts training at this point. I'll go talk to these. I can give them something different. And I went to the back door after the event, me and my friend Chip, knocked on the door, told one of the wrestlers what we wanted to do. He said, hang out here for a second and I'll get the guy. He'll come out here and talk to you. So the guy comes out there and I told him who we were. And he said, well, how much training do you have? I said, well, I've got like 6 years of martial arts training. I said, he doesn't have any training. And all he basically said was, we just really don't need anybody right now. And I didn't find out till later that this was Dale, who's a very noted professional wrestler and one of the guys that probably should be in the Hall of Fame. But it's the difference between then and now. If I'd have done this now at 19 years old, it's one of those things where I would come home and put it on Facebook and Instagram. I got turned down from being a wrestler, blah, blah, blah. And it would go all over the place. But back then it was like, oh, okay, fine. We got in the car. We left. We didn't even think about it the next day. You know, they turned us down. Okay, we'll move on from here. They didn't need us. It's the difference between then and now. And I appreciate the fact that he came out there and he was
a gazillion offers the day after from all the promoters. If it did happen now.
Yeah. Well, it's like the thing we discussed before about the thing with Don Carnoodle, where he did that challenge with Roop, which was basically the same, almost the same thing, except it was a shoot with them and you had 10 minutes to beat him and Carnoodle lost. And I think it was in a sugar hold. But here's the thing where Don Carnoodle comes in, loses to Roop, but Ole and Gene Anderson see it and they say, oh, well, we're going to train you and make you a star. So I go in 81, start in the submission hold, get out when he's still fresh, and I get erased from existence, basically. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want nothing to do with it. So, you know, it's the difference between promotions. It's the difference between people that you're dealing with. But that's one of the reasons I ended up with AMW. It was kind of like this lifelong dream of what could have been, because I told Bob, and he kind of scoffed at this, but while I was sitting back there after Angelo made his offer to me, I thought for a brief second, why don't I offer Angelo the opportunity to hire me in lieu of the $1,000 and go to work for these guys, you know? And Bob told me, he said, you're much better off with the money. And that's probably true. And the way it turned out was probably for the best. I would have had some good stories out of it. Who knows where I'd be right now, but I stayed with martial arts. I trained a lot of great people. I'm happy with the way it turned out. I got to know the people in AMW. I got to meet a lot of great wrestlers and a lot of really famous people that are just the nicest people in the world. And I'm very happy with the way things turned out now. And I just hope we can get past this COVID thing and everybody can get back to wrestling full time. Yeah. And the crowds can get back in there and everybody can just be happy.
Absolutely. And that's more than anything. I think, Benny, we've mentioned it at least three or four times, what it feels like in the last month. There's almost nothing I miss more than just going to a live show, be it wrestling, theater, something. VCW, the big promotion here in Virginia, my wife and I have been regulars there for a long time, and I haven't missed a show in ages. And as soon as COVID's over and they're back to it, first in line, I tell you what. But Mr. Harding, I appreciate all your time.
Which
I know.
Which one is it?
VCW, Virginia Championship Wrestling.
Which one you say in West Virginia? Oh, okay. I thought you said BCW for a minute.
No, VCW, Virginia Championship Wrestling.
Okay.
But no, it's been great. I appreciate all your time. You obviously, you know, it's just an incredible story. You are like I said earlier, you are a unique part of wrestling history. And when Jim Cornette wants to talk to you or about you, you know you're important. Love him or hate him, that man respects wrestling history. So if you're on his lips, then you definitely did something right.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate, again, all your time. We are Dan and Benny in the Ring. Anywhere podcasts can be listened to, you can check us out on Facebook, Dan and Benny in the Ring podcast. So don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. For the BS Express himself, Benny Scala, for William Harding and the man who defeated the Sugar Hole Challenge, I'm Dan Spasciano. Have a good night, everyone. And as always, happy wrestling.